Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/boardrecruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
That's Doc Watson, one of the many artists you can hear on the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, when we share a wide variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music with you from 5:30 to 7 a.m. Each week, your hosts Dan Schrammick and Stephen Morrison bring you some of our favorite new releases and plenty of vintage favorites. It's a great way to start your Fridays, discover some new music, and find out about shows and festivals coming to the area. You can also find show playlists and listen to archive shows on demand via our website at kboo.fm and also via our free mobile app. That's the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, where you hear a variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music from 5:30 to 7, right here on KBOO. We hope you'll join us.
Hi, I'm Cory Doctorow, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Jamie Partridge. Our topic is University Workers on Strike Against Repression and for Palestine. Our guests this evening are Sarah Mason and Jack Davies with UAW Local 4811 of the University of California. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
Thanks for hosting us.
So this week, in an historic first, at least in my lifetime, university workers have withheld their labor in an unfair labor practices strike to protest their administration's interference with the workers' anti-war activities on campus. But before we get into the details about the strike, tell our listeners about the types of jobs that your members do, what kind of work you do, and how you got active in the union, what position you have in the union.
Yeah, so our union represents 48,000 workers across many different titles. It includes teaching assistants, graduate student instructors, tutors, readers, student researchers, research assistants, postdocs.
Academic researchers.
I work as a researcher currently for the Labor Center here on campus. I've also worked as a teaching assistant. I personally got involved in the union because I understood it to be a vehicle through which my coworkers and I could assert some power in our workplace and really get our needs met.
Go ahead, Jack.
I myself usually work as a teaching instructor, either as an assistant to a course that's been taught by a lecturer or professor, or teaching my own class as the instructor.
And how did you get active in the union? And what position do you hold, if any?
Well, both of us have, until very recently, officers. The new leadership came in on May 5. So I was the unit chair of our local branch here at Santa Cruz. Sarah was a head steward.
Yeah, I was a head steward, and now we're both rank and file members.
That's right. That's right. We've both been involved for, you know, since the minute we got here. We went to orientations that are held every fall, and just went straight to the membership meeting after that, and the rest is history.
All right. So the UAW has a new national leadership swept into power by a reform caucus called the UAWD, Uniting All Workers for Democracy, which not only has won a huge recent strike victory with the big three auto manufacturers and penetrated the South with a historic organizing win at the Chattanooga Volkswagen plant, but was one of the first national unions to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. And the UAW, United Auto Workers, has a significant section of university workers who, in the University of California system, recently won a transformative strike. How did all this influence the decision of your local 4811 to take this current strike action?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that we could say about this. I mean, the first thing that I'll say is that it certainly doesn't hurt to have a president of our international union who isn't afraid of strike action. The other thing that I'll say is, you know, the strike in 2022, I think, you know, it was a 6-week long strike. Workers on our campus voted 4 out of 5 to continue the strike, so to reject the tentative agreement. We thought we could win more, and we were intent on staying out longer to win it. But that kind of action, that kind of like prolonged strike action, I think built up a muscle in the UC system among academic workers. And so you're seeing some of that, our ability to kind of mobilize for the strike action with very little preparation. Some of that really has to do with the muscle that was built up in 2022. I think another thing that is important to say is that, you know, on our campus, we, I think, have created a culture where it's not, we don't understand that we need to be at a contract campaign or a contract fight in order to win concessions from our employer. We sort of understand that, you know, at any moment when an issue arises, we can organize around it and we can fight to win. And so since October 7th, there's been some work that's been going on in laboratories among student researchers, focusing on labs that receive funding from the Department of Defense or from military contractors. And that organizing has been around the right to refuse that funding. And there have been some successes in getting departments to move on that. I think that is also something that you're seeing lay the basis for the kind of strike action that's taking place now. Is there anything you want to add to that, Jack?
No, I think that's pretty comprehensive. I would just say, just to put maybe a slightly finer point on one part here, it definitely helps to have this new leadership and to have these examples. And, you know, our current strike is replicating the stand-up model that was innovated in the last contract negotiation fight in auto. But I think the deeper thing that makes it possible for the current leadership of our local to call this action is the, you know, sequences of strikes that we've had here and the depth and readiness of rank and file to take action when they see their coworkers attacked or when issues they care about are being repressed. I think this is what really makes this possible.
Well, so many of our listeners may be confused or wondering how this is an unfair labor practices strike. To remind our listeners, the term unfair labor practice means a violation of the National Labor Relations Act, Section 8A1, which states that the employer is prohibited from interference, restraint, or coercion directed against union or other collective activity. Section 7 of the NLRA states that employees have the right to engage in, quote, concerted activities for the purpose of collective bargaining or other mutual aid and protection, unquote. How does the UC administration calling the cops to beat up pro-Palestine student protesters constitute an unfair labor practice? That's kind of wonky, but you know.
No. Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you.
We're union people. We know this stuff.
For sure. But I can understand some of the confusion. I think the first thing to point out is that many union members are in these encampments. So when a grab worker, like a comrade or a colleague of mine, is down in Los Angeles and is beaten up, is arrested, is suspended, has charges against them, that de facto way acts as a firing. And we've got very robust protections against discipline and termination that need to be followed to the letter in our contract. And this just jumped all the way over this, say nothing of how reprehensible it is to see, our students, lecturers, and faculty, among other members of the community, being treated in this way, by the boss. So this, is clearly a workplace issue. As for the legal technicalities, I think it sort of starts and ends there. And yesterday, we learned that an attempt to enjoin the strike, the UC seeking emergency injunctive relief failed. So it seems clear that the legal standing of the strike has passed that test already. But I would say more generally that where my boss invests its endowment, where the research that my colleagues the use that my colleagues' research is put to. By eventually the Department of Defense or whoever else, or how my boss responds to legitimate protests and criticism on campus. These are all workplace issues, like fundamentally and directly, and we have the right to fight back over that as workers. And we, I think, not only can and should, but have an obligation to bring worker power to bear on these matters.
So you mentioned that the university administration had tried to seek injunctive relief from the unfair labor practice charge, and that was denied. Tell us a little bit more about how the university administration is reacting, and what are the main demands of the strike?
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about how the administration is reacting. I think from our perspective, they're really scrambling.
Yeah.
I think it's been interesting to see. I mean, we sort of anticipated, given what's happened on other campuses, a police response. We've anticipated that there would be some police repression, and the local campus administration here has really taken a different tack. They responded the first week of the strike by moving all instruction to remote. So classes, sections, everything is on Zoom. They also locked, from what we understand, a majority of the buildings on campuses. So students and faculty who had gone to try to access their office or to attend class that they assumed would be in person actually found that they were locked out of the buildings. Do you want to talk a little bit about the demands?
Yeah. Okay, so the demands of the strike, I mean, first and foremost, the things that would address the issues in the unfair labor practice charges would be that, all charges are dropped against, obviously, union members, but there's just no world in which you can drop these charges against union members and not against people who are outside of our union, but within the UC, lecturers, faculty, students, etc. So number one, like amnesty, all forms, criminal charges, conduct. Student conduct charges, all these charges need to be dropped. When the strike authorization, in the meeting that the strike authorization vote was passed in the joint council of our union, there was also the passing of a document or resolution that was called Our Demands in Support of Palestine. And these included, as I say, dropping the charges, also a demand for guarantees around free speech and protected speech, but then specifically divestment from UC's holdings, direct and indirect holdings, in companies that benefit from the occupation in Palestine, as well as companies that produce technologies of weaponry and surveillance. In addition, we want transitional funding for, Sarah mentioned earlier, these researchers in labs here whose research is funded by the Department of Defense and other such agencies, where for example the algorithms that you might develop to map the sky in astronomy are also useful for border enforcement to monitor and surveil the southern border. These kinds of things are these are not the reasons that workers, and union members on our campus come to do their work and show up every day to advance science. And in certain cases, people want to get out of that situation. But it's a very difficult prospect just to walk out of your funded lab position into another. So we're demanding some centrally funded transitional funding such that these workers can take some time to figure out alternative arrangements and be supported while they do that.
All right. So members of your local voted overwhelmingly to authorize this UOP strike. How did you all get to that place? What is the level of union member participation, the participation of non-worker students and other unions, community members and groups?
I could talk a little bit about like what the participation looks like on our campus. So it's interesting. I mean, I think one of the reasons why we have gone out first as the first campus in the stand-up strike is because workers on our campus were already talking about the possibility of taking labor action a week before the events transpired at UCLA. And what this looked like was basically an activation of our stewards network. So we have a pretty robust stewards network with
In departments,
right? So stewards in, you know, the majority of departments on our campus. We had a monthly membership meeting that, you know, someone raised the question of responding to the call from the Palestinian Federation of Trade Unions about taking strike action on May 1st and May 15th, Nakba Day. And that meeting was about, it was attended by about 75 people. And so, you know, we discussed it a bit, but ultimately we came to the conclusion that, you know, look, we have like 1,000 workers on our campus. 75 people can't really make the call about whether or not to walk out. And so what we need to do is we need to go back to our departments and we need to talk with workers there. We need to talk with people who aren't at this meeting and see what the appetite is for this kind of thing. And so over the period of about, I don't know, 4 or 5 days, workers from 23 out of 33 departments held meetings. We then held a mass meeting where I think about, 300 people, 250 people attended. And we heard report backs from 23 stewards about what people in their departments said that they were willing to do. And then we decided to take action on May 1st and walk out. And that was an unsanctioned action, but it just so happened that it, you know, coincided with this incredible police repression that happened at UCLA. And so on the morning that we participated in this walkout in March, we actually received word from our executive board that a strike authorization vote would be coming down. Since then, I mean, I think people have just been in a constant state of mobilization here. I can't, maybe Jack can say more about what things have looked like on other campuses.
If you've just tuned in, this is Labor Radio, KBOO Portland, community-supported, listener-sponsored, non-corporate community radio. This is our membership drive, and we depend on you. Like your union dues, which protects your job, like your church tithe, which protects your spirit, the KBOO membership protects your access to information, news and public affairs that you can use in your daily life, information you can use in conversation with your coworkers, friends, families, neighbors, political comrades. Go to our website, kboo.fm, and donate now.
What I'd say firstly, just to add a small footnote to what Sarah was saying, the reason for talking about taking labor action on May 1, International Workers' Day, and on May 15, on Nakba Day, was that the Gaza branch of the Palestinian General Federation of Trade Unions had put out a call for solidarity and specifically for strike action on those days to workers of the world. And so we did walk out on May 1. We decided through this, you know, very intensive deliberative process that Sarah described, but also I'm just, you know, immensely proud to be able to, you know, say on your program that May 15, Nakba Day, was the day that the strike authorization vote in our union passed, and it was declared that we would be taking strike action, even if we didn't strike that day. That to me, you know, was a deeply important and meaningful thing. I think the situation on the campuses, I mean, we heard yesterday that that UCLA and UC Davis will stand up and join the strike on Tuesday after the Monday holiday. And I think there's a way that, you know, we were already doing this kind of process because, you know, organizing a strike is a little bit different to organizing other forms of action insofar as you need to get a broad number of people who are actually working there to participate in the action. It can't be a small number of people taking an action. It has to be broad, or else you'll get crushed. And so we were, as Sarah was saying, we were probably a little bit ahead in some of those ways. So it's taken a little bit longer for some of these other campuses to unfurl this process since the SAV, the strike authorization vote, was announced. I will say it appears to me, and I can't really speak to this because I'm not on the ground anywhere else, but the fact of the strike starting here, of us like holding it down, of us overcoming these initial attempts to isolate us locally, as Sarah was saying, shifting everything remote, our work with the encampment here down at the base, the encampment shifted from up on campus down to join us at the base at the picket. All these things have, I think, accelerated that process elsewhere. It brings the reality of the strike, I think, firmer into picture. And it becomes, it's an easier prospect to join a strike that's already going rather than, and beginning one for the first day. So I think these are important things. I will say also our comrades on some of these campuses were really caught up in jail support and trying to help people who were injured. A lot of work has to go into that kind of this kind of anti-repression organizing when you face what those folks had to face. So yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I'll say another thing, which is I think we're experiencing something very similar to our union siblings in Otto, where we see the way that having, sort of one campus called out first or one plant called out first sort of generates this momentum that is infectious and helps to kind of bolster organizing on other campuses.
All right. Well, talk a little bit about participation. You mentioned that folks from the encampment, you have an encampment at Santa Cruz and folks have joined the picket line. What about other unions or community members?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, I can say so. I've been organizing a rally. We're having a big rally today to welcome our comrades from UCLA and UC Davis to the picket lines next week. And that rally, we have headline speakers from ILWU Local 10, Local 34, who are really veterans of the labor movement, both who participated in organizing against handling cargo from apartheid South Africa, who organized a West Coast port shutdown against the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. We've also had Teamsters out here. UPS drivers refuse to cross our picket line. UC is not receiving packages at this time. There's been a tremendous outpouring of support from labor unions, both locally, nationally, and internationally.
That's right. I just had a couple of smaller additional examples to the ones Sarah listed. The SMART, the union for the Metro bus drivers here, are not crossing the line. So people are trying to get up onto campus. Not that there are classes running in person right now, but they're not crossing the picket. And we've had down here other local unions, ASME 3299, really coming out in big numbers and joining us on the picket. We had SEIU yesterday. SCFA, the Santa Cruz Faculty Association, is actually a labor union. Our campus is the only one with a sort of bona fide labor union for its faculty association. They've been out here. They've also been doing their own organizing, going through the departments, talking to people, helping, their coworkers fall on the right side of this picket line that now exists.
You mentioned that other unions across the country had been responding to your strike. Can you say what you know about other university workers' unions across the country and generally their response to the repression of student pro-Palestine protests?
Yeah. So it's hard to say anything too concrete here because things are in their early stages, but we have comrades in the higher ed labor movement around the country, many of whom we've learned from, they've learned from us. We meet regularly to discuss strike strategy in particular, building campaigns, all these sorts of things. And they've been extremely moved by, the very bold step that has been taken here in our local. Some of these, two of them in particular at Dartmouth and Boston University, were already on strike in their contract campaigns. So they're sort of reconfiguring, trying to figure out how, because these things have happened at their universities as well. Of course, UC is not unique in this around the country right now. There's also a quirk, though, that we're on, with the exception of UC Berkeley and UC Merced, we're on what's called the quarter system. We have four academic quarters corresponding to the seasons, whereas most universities in the country have two semesters. And this means we go a bit later. So other comrades at universities who I think could have really responded very forcefully and in ways that resemble us, they're already in the summer. And that's it's a much different prospect striking in the summer when you work at a university than in the regular term, which is just to say, none of us can know how this will unfold in once the fall semester rolls around in August, September.
That was my next question. What do you see happening going forward in this struggle for student and worker rights and Palestinian liberation, especially given that summer is a much more quiet time? I know you said none of us can predict, but do you have any?
Right, it's hard to say. I wouldn't want to get ahead of the moment and look back on this and sound silly, but we've seen the way that the encampment movement ripped across this country after one popped up at Columbia and faced repression. As I was saying earlier, there are some differences organizing strikes as opposed to something like an encampment, but it's not hard to see a pattern of this, and ultimately, ideally, beyond our sector. Workers around this country are getting the shit kicked out of them on this issue. People being fired, people are being silenced, people are being disciplined for taking, in some cases, very modest stances in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle right now, and this is time that the workers hit back. And what I'm most proud of, and I think is most important maybe about just our local current sequence of struggle here, is that it gives an example. It gives an example that can be taken up and replicated. Whether that happens is up to the rank and file, up to workers everywhere, and of course not only workers in unions but workers as such in this country.
Right. So do you have any last words before we wrap up that you want to share with our listeners about this struggle?
Yeah. I think one thing that we've been talking about a lot is something that maybe people don't quite understand, which is that university workers are not so far removed from the supply chain of war production. Millions and tens of millions of dollars, billions of dollars even, flow into laboratories on our campuses where unionized researchers are working. And I think when I think about the, one of the horizons of this current moment, I really look to the organizing that's going on in labs on our campus, where research workers are sort of understanding themselves as workers in this supply chain and are saying, actually, no, we can refuse this work. We can organize together to say that we do not want our research to fuel the war machine, and they're doing just that. And I think, we've been involved in this group called Researchers Against War, and there are members on different campuses across the country, and I would hope that this would continue and would grow.
So I have a related comment, but to make it a bit more general, something that we experienced while gearing up for this strike is that those departments on our campus, like on STEM side, in the hard sciences, let's say, that were doing this Researchers Against War organizing, this intensive meeting and discussion about where the funding comes from for their research, where the ultimate application of their research is, those departments were much, much faster and deeper to respond when this moment came down where a strike was on the cards. And what that's taught me, and this is by comparison to other departments, which are which are definitely strong and getting there, but it was like a little bit more of a push. It was like a little bit more of a like where did this come from? So this to me is like a real lesson to any worker around the country who is outraged by what's going on in Palestine and wants to get organizing, that doing this quiet, hard, frustrating, head against the wall thing where you're just slowly trying to organize in your place of work, it looks like it's going nowhere, you get only what feels like partial victories, although I think the ones that we've had here, especially in two departments, are more than partial. I think they're very significant, but when you are doing that, you are getting ready to fight, whether it feels like that or not, you are getting ready to fight. And when when history opens a door, you're there, and it even just cracks open the door a little bit, you're there to barge through it. And I just want to say this to anyone listening who's who's a labor organizer and who wants to organize around Palestine, just doing that thankless, tireless stuff in your with your immediate coworkers right now will be preparing you for the kinds of fights that we're engaging in right now.
That's right. I think Mike Davis calls it patient gardening.
That's right. We're going to be patient gardeners.
We're going to be patient gardeners.
Yeah, yeah.
Californian Mike Davis.
That's right. That's right.
So how can our listeners keep up with your struggle, and how can they help?
One thing that you can do, so we don't have a hardship fund up yet to donate to, you can follow us on Instagram at PayUsMoreUCSC. One thing that you'll see there is oftentimes requests to donate to our strike kitchen. We're keeping people fed on the picket line, and we can always use support with that.
Also follow at PayUsMoreUCSC on Twitter or X. You get a bit more analysis there.
Right. That's right. That's right.
Pay Us More UCSC.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, that wraps it up for this evening's show. You've been listening to Sarah Mason and Jack Davies of the University of California Student Worker Union, UAW 4811. I'm Jamie Partridge. This is Labor Radio this Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kbu.fm.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Welcome to Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. Oregon Justice Resource Center Women's Justice Project has released a report titled Death by a Thousand Cuts, Volume 2, on conditions at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, Oregon's only women's prison. Volume 1, released in 2023, outlined the long-standing serious problems and entrenched toxic culture at Coffee Creek, and despite actions and rhetoric by the Oregon Department of Corrections and the Governor's Office,